How did you think of that? With Temple Grandin.
I'm Sherry Quinn. The demand for jobs in STEM fields is rising in the United States, yet there is a looming STEM workforce shortage. Nearly 2 million high-tech and high-paying jobs are projected to go unfilled over the next several years. Seeds of solutions to this dilemma are scattered across the landscape of STEM education, and they are sprouting. On How Do You Think of That? With Temple Grandin, we illuminate innovators in the STEM fields, we delve into their thought processes, poke about, and explore what makes them tick, ultimately unleashing how personal experiences in life and education lead to successful careers, discoveries, and inventions. Joining us on this episode, All the Good Teachers, is Jared Ashcroft.
I teach chemistry right now at Pasadena City College.
Temple and Jared discuss the role community colleges can play in supplying a steady STEM workforce, ways the education system falls short, and how it can improve outcomes for students, the impact of one good teacher, and more.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine.
I see you've got, my grandpa had all sorts of outfits like that as well. He was raised in New Mexico and Colorado.
Oh, he had all kinds of Western shirts too?
Oh yeah, he was raised on the Navajo Indian Reservation.
Okay, I'll always try to wear different ones.
Jared Ashcroft is the principal investigator in the Micro Nanotechnology Education Center.
So that's basically a community college advanced technological education grant from the NSF. Our goal is for us to support programs in micro nanotechnology across the country at community colleges to educate technicians. You know, like how can we get students from community colleges directly into industry? Like semiconductors is huge right now.
Okay, now what kind of technician jobs are these?
Well, so like for instance, the semiconductor industry right now is huge. There's billions of dollars going towards it. And so we need students who can just run the instruments in those fabs, you know, the semiconductor fabrication. I mean, they're building, from what I know right now, four or five brand new ones. Intel's going to be building one in Ohio. The Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC, is building one in Phoenix. I think Intel's actually going to build one in Phoenix as well.
Okay, so we have to do that to get our supply chain less concentrated.
Well, it is. I mean, it's trying. And you know, all of the fabs we're building in the U.S. are still nothing compared to what they have in Taiwan and China. I mean, we're still going to be pretty small, but at least we're going to have something that we can start making our own chips.
Let me tell you, it's not that much different than the meat industry. And this, we really learned that big is fragile. When two big pork plants went down due to COVID and 300,000 head of pigs had to be destroyed and just thrown away. Horrible welfare, horrible food waste. Now, the thing is, a more distributed supply chain doesn't break it as easily. But it's a lot sturdier. It's going to be more costly. And it's going to be just like what's happening now in the beef industry. People are building a whole lot of little tiny plants now.
Yeah.
But in order to compete with the big boys, you have to be making some kind of specialized product, organic, special breed of cattle like Wagyu, grass-fed, family ranchers, some kind of, you know, niche. But when the big supply chain breaks, you can convert all those little plants to regular.
Well, and that's, my dad actually has a goat farm in New Mexico, so he knows a little bit about farming, but it is true. I mean, our semiconductor fabrications, we are way too reliant on the fabrication that's manufacturing that's going on outside of the U.S. But right now, the big problem is that we're going to have all these new, bigger fabs come up. And yeah, we do have some smaller ones that we still want to support, but to be honest, we don't have the technicians ready right now that can run those fabs. So our center, one of our big aims is how can we create new semiconductor manufacturing programs across the country? So that's just one example. And it's different now because a lot of those fabs are ran automatic. They're all automated. So it's not necessarily training the students in this is how you create a semiconductor chip.
No, you don't teach them to build them. Yeah.
No, it's more about, you know, can you monitor the automation that's going on? Can you troubleshoot, problem solve? So if there is sort of a disruption in that fab, that you can either fix it yourself or at least go up to the next person that says, hey, something's going on and we need to get on this.
The thing I want to talk about, my different kinds of minds. Now, I was supposed to go on inside a big fab and COVID kept me out, but I got to see the confidential video of it. And I can tell you, there's plenty of stuff in there for my kind of mind to work on. You see, you have the visual thinkers like me who absolutely cannot do algebra. I can't do chemistry. But all the mechanical things I saw in that fab factory, that's going to break. That has to be maintained. And the person that's going to be able to fix that might be that maintenance person that doesn't know how to do algebra. And you need us to keep that fab plant running. You see, then you got the mathematical heads. You're a chemist. So that's the more mathematical thinking.
Jared explains some of the challenges community colleges face when developing training programs for specialized technical jobs.
Now, a lot of our stuff is focused on faculty professional development. How can we increase the number of faculty working in micro nanotech at community colleges? You know, how can we help them with their curriculum? There's not a lot of experts in micro nanotech, like semiconductor manufacturing or nanobiotech with vaccines. There's not a lot of us in community colleges that are experts in any of that. Four-year universities are where most of the experts are. So we've got to figure out, how do we create programs that can train students in semiconductor manufacturing whenever our faculty are not necessarily the experts? How can we work with industry so they can, you know, sort of help bridge some of the knowledge
If the community college is located near a factory, well, then the students ought to be visiting the factory, obviously.
Yes.
But in a lot of cases, that's not going to be true.
Ideally, what I would love to create is an apprenticeship program where students are taking a year-long program at a community college where the first semester is just focused on intro to nano, intro to some of the concepts. And then the second semester, they would continue finishing the classes, but then they're doing the apprenticeship at the industry, like get them into those fabs and into what they're actually going to be working on. Because that way you really bridge, here's some basic skills that we can teach very well at community colleges, but then they're also going to get the experience of working in a fab or working with the higher end equipment that we just can't reproduce or mimic.
No, you can't.
It's way too expensive and we don't have the money. The issue is we've got to have industry support it and fund it, because community colleges don't have the money right now.
No.
Probably they've never had the money for internships or apprenticeships programs. So can we get industry to, or at least do a pilot?
Well, one of the problems is proximity, because I mean, I looked up things like, I talked to people that manage the construction for our new animal science building and our new chemistry building here. And there's all kinds of electrician apprenticeships jobs that are easy to get. But you see, electricity work, it's everywhere in terms of being able to do hands-on and be able to be with, you know, skilled people. The problem with the microchip fabrication is plants are only in a few places, where electrical work, it's everywhere. So that makes it easier to teach that.
Yeah, well, we're told the same problem with semiconductor plants and any kind of micro nanotech jobs. Now, that's one of our other missions at MinTech, Micro Nanotechnology Education Center, is kind of doing an analysis and a study. Like, we're working with it's called SEMI. They're a big conglomerate of semiconductor companies. They have like 4,000, about 800 in the US. And you know, just ask them, where are your plants at? Where are they going to be? So that then we can, all right, like for instance, they're going to build one in Columbus, Ohio. So we're reaching out to Columbus State Community College and asking them, hey, can we meet with you, help you see how we can help you set it up? TSMC is going to be in Phoenix. So we reach out to Maricopa Community College District or Rio Salado and say, you know, what can we do to help? And we do have to be very targeted in which community colleges that we can, you know, approach and work with, because we do have to, at least for semiconductors, we do need something in the area where the students can get a job.
Well, they have to be physically close to it.
That to me is the key, is, you know, how do we get programs at community colleges that really, that we can find those students and get them into technical education programs, so that then we can tell industry, look, here's the technicians that you can hire, work with us, tell us what you want us to teach, how do we get them prepared? Because part of the problem is community college faculty, we don't necessarily know what's going on in those industry. Like we're not really up to date on what trends there are. And we really need the industry to come into our meetings and talk to us and say, this is what we need you to teach. It's not going to be the high level calculus. And so that's our goal, you know, is let's find the students and let's find the workers that can go directly from community colleges to one is the fact. I mean, another interesting one is COVID's a great example. I mean, all the COVID vaccines and almost all the COVID tests are all nano-based. You know, that delivery system is all nano. So how does nano and biotechnology sort of converge with another? And then how do we, you know, educate the students to understand how science converges and how these, you know, different disciplines need each other in order to accomplish
tasks. They do need each other.
And so that's another big aspect of our center is, you know, working on how do we bring in people from biotech, nanotech, laser tech, material science, get them all talking together so that then we can develop a lot more interesting programs for students. Because a big part of it is, you know, how do we retain students? How do we make them interested in our programs? One of it is let's converge all these sciences where then it gets really interesting. Make the science really fun for them, make these technical education programs hands-on so that a lot of these students who were losing, because again, they might not be able to do the algebra or the calculus or whatever that high, you know, stuff is that they think that they need in order to get the one direction. It gives them a way to go in order to, here's an outcome that you can get and still get a job from a community college. Because that's our job. I mean, our job in a community college is let's give them different pathways. Either you can transfer or you end up with an outcome with a certificate.
Well, I think another thing you've got to do is I've been kind of looking into a lot of how do students get into careers.
And part of our problem, I think, as educators in STEM is that we're not good at marketing and we're not good at outreach. We're not really good at selling ourselves and selling what our product is. I'm a chemist, so I've taught general chemistry a long time, and it's some of the most uninspiring, unengaging classes I've ever seen. Your initial chemistry classes are usually boring. They're usually overly difficult, overly challenging when they don't need to be. And instead of being motivating to get students through, they're just deflating and students just give up. And so I think part of it, especially at community colleges and with technical education programs, we can focus on the hands-on components. You know, we can use undergraduate research as a way to get students interested. Well, I mean, and make it where people actually like science. I mean, if you go to a class and you're unengaged and you hate the lab, I mean, STEM, we have labs. Like, how can you make labs uninteresting? And for some reason, especially as chemists, we've done it. You know, make them fun, make them exciting, make them so that they're thinking through the problems. Trust that the students are a lot smarter than what they think they are, you know, and what I think a lot of teachers think they are. I mean, students, if you give them a lot of leeway and if you give them a, hey, solve this problem, a lot of them are going to really get engaged and get into it. I mean, at the end, make, you know, have a presentation they could do or send them to a conference. I actually had a student write one of my undergraduate research projects and classes up as a paper because he did such a good job. Give them something that they can do at the end of it so that they have sort of a win, right? And especially at community colleges, whenever the students need a win that gets them feeling confident. And then I think what you'll see and what I know you'll see is that the next class, they'll get more engaged, they'll be able to do better, and it'll keep growing and growing until by the time they're transferred, I think that they're ready to really do STEM in a way that is expected of students.
The other thing I think we need to be doing, taking a much longer term view. I've had a slide I've had for quite a while that asks, where is a student 10 years after high school? And I can take a places where I don't want them to be, that's for sure. But all kinds of, you know, out in a really good job, you know, with opportunities for career advancement, then you've done a good job educating them. What I see in a lot of schools, all they can think about is passing the state tests 10 years later. 10 years later for me, I mean, as a rotten student, I barely graduated from high school, barely, still didn't know how to do algebra, went into a tiny little startup college that wasn't even accredited at the time, and had a lot of real young teachers in it, but also older ones. And 10 years later, I was doing those dipping vat projects that were in the movie, and I finished my master's degree by that point. What is the goal? And I'm seeing too many students today where basic writing skills are horrible. And I don't care what industry you're in, you've got to be able to write a business letter. I'm not saying write beautiful creative writing, but just write a clear little project proposal or something like that.
Well, and I think part of the issue is that like our community colleges in California, we're so focused on transfer. It's like a one size fits all pathway. And I think that's just the wrong.
Well, I think it's a problem.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and we've got to figure out how do we create, I mean, there's the guided pathways programs, which are great, but again, they all focus on transfer. How can we create a guided pathways program that focuses on here's all the different options that you could take? Maybe you want to do a transfer. Maybe you want to do a STEM technical education like nanotech, biotech, laser tech. Maybe you want to do a health science technical education pathway like nursing or dentistry.
Yeah, that's right.
But like, you know, how do we, or a more hands-on like, you know, electrician or car mechanic or something like that. How do you create a program for first year students coming into community colleges where a lot of the, I mean, honestly, elitist faculty at community colleges who think the only good pathway is a transfer and go into the four-year university,
well,
which is totally
unrealistic. We need to get over that because I spent 25 years involved with heavy commercial instruction, building great big huge packing plants.
Yeah.
People, I know people that own gigantic metal fabrication shops, patents, they plaster them on their walls and make posters out of them, put them on their walls. Another guy, I call him Stainless Steel Willy Wonka. I can't tell you what he does, but he has a private jet. He's my age and a gigantic $1 trillion factory. And I think that's a really good outcome. It wasn't a college outcome.
Well, and I think we've got to start being realistic. I mean, Pasadena City College, where I work, right now we have about 20,000 students there a year. You know, at the most, we've had like 28,000. And if you really think about it, how many can we transfer realistically? No. Maybe at the most 4,000 a year. That's not even really 20% of our campus.
Or just under 20%, maybe.
And yeah, I mean, in our transfer statistics over, I think, a three-year period is something like 10% or 12%. And so you have to ask yourself, well, all right, what's happening to the other 80%? Like, there is not room at four-year universities for everybody to transfer. There's no way 4 years can take them all. And so it's a little bit dishonest whenever you're telling every community college student, oh, yeah, you're all going to be able to transfer, where in reality it's like, no, you're not, because there's just not enough spots. Ideal world, you know, pipe dream in a way is everyone can transfer and everyone can get a degree at a four-year
university.
Well,
let's look at way I would look at it is, okay, the transfer is one route. All right, let's look at the other 85% or whatever it is that they're not going to transfer. And then I want to start sorting those into what I would consider, because my mind is bottom-up thinking. I tend to sort things. So yeah. I want to take that other 85%. All right, what are good outcomes? Like became an electrician, for example. Or went into nanotechnology or became a nurse. I mean, something that's a decent outcome. I want to like see how many of them get out good outcomes like that in a field, and then how many of them just flunked out. And yes. Then very carefully looking at the data and seeing the reason. One thing I have found with graduate students is personal problems that break up the boyfriend, stuff like that, trash a career. I've seen that happen. But really start figuring out what we can do. There's different career paths. Because you look at countries like Holland, and they are doing that. They don't stick their nose up at tech. In fact, if you want to build a poultry processing plant right now, you're going to have to bring it over here in 100 shipping containers. Because we don't make it anymore.
Yeah, well, and I mean, and I think this is a really negative about our education system is we don't really follow outcomes, right? I mean, community college students finish, and then we really don't follow where they go afterwards.
We need to be following where they go.
Yes.
We need to be looking at where is the kid 10 years in the future? Okay, you can take a guy that took a single welding class in high school. I know three of those, and two of them turned into big businesses, and one is a small shop. All would be autistic, rotten student in school. And then you have the ones that unfortunately get into drugs or something like that, which does not make a good outcome. You've got ones where they're lighting the candle at both ends and they're so overworked trying to, where money is just such an issue. I tend to look at outcomes. In fact, in the work that I've done on animal welfare, the trend now is not to tell you what kind of a housing you should put your dairy cattle in, but look at the outcomes of bad welfare, like lameness or swollen joints, or she gives more milk. You're looking at outcomes.
Yeah, well, and I think that's where we fail a little bit as a, education in the U.S. is that we don't do a good job of following once they leave and say, all right, 3 years after you left PCC, where are you at? Or 2 years. And it's very hard. I mean, it's a challenge, because you have to rely on students doing surveys or keeping track of them. And there's so many students. How do you do it?
Well,
I do surveys all the time and no one ever answers them.
Now, one of the things that is easy to track, and it's unfortunately the negative stuff, is a student that doesn't complete the community college program.
Yeah.
And you could start looking at it by different majors. And why did they drop out? The real positive outcome that, you're going to have to track them after they leave.
Well, but the negative outcomes are usually a lot more telling than, it's like, I always tell people, tell me what I'm doing wrong.
It would be good, looking at the negative outcomes.
Yeah. And then you'd have to make sure to develop a sort of a survey as you leave. Would you be willing to fill out this survey? Why did you leave? What happened? And then from that data, we could definitely figure. And I think that you'd have to do it at the discipline level, like chemistry or STEM.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Would have to say, hey, you know what? Let's see if students are not passing our classes, if they'd be willing to do a survey or focus groups or something so that we could collect that data point. And then you can see if there's any trends, because that's what we like. Is there some trends that we're seeing? And then from that data, you can work backwards and say, all right, what can we do in order to support this challenge that's come up and this obstacle so that we can keep those students who might be all having similar problems or having similar challenges that's making them stop?
That's right.
And then you get to see where a lot of the high-level students that have been doing research end up. And at least you can say, look, students who got involved in this undergraduate research program, 90% of them ended up transferring and about half of them end up in graduate school, which is about what the number is.
Temple says she succeeded in college because she had some excellent teachers who spent time tutoring her outside the classroom. Temple and Jared express the importance of one-on-one mentoring and acknowledge that it's not possible with every student and suggest some solutions.
And I went into Franklin Pierce College. It was startup school at that point, 400 and some students. And the math class, thank goodness, wasn't algebra. It was a lot of statistics on probability matrices. And Mr. Dion, the nice math teacher, brand new math teacher, tutored me in his office. Thank you, Mr. Dion. Very, very important.
Ideally, that one-on-one relationship or those close relationships that you get with students is what get a lot of students through. The issue with that is that, we have, our STEM faculty at PCC, we're talking about 80 teachers, 80 professors, and, you've got 5,000 students. And in reality, the majority of the faculty are not really interested in mentoring like that. So how do you get it so that all of the students can sort of get mentoring like that? Because that is absolutely what you need, is more.
One of the things I did when I was in graduate school, I went to another graduate student and I paid her by doing repairs in her mother's bar. I would have flunked statistics if it hadn't been for her. That was something I just did on my own. You see, there was no disabilities department. It was like somehow get tutoring before I flunk. And that's what I did.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, this bar was real scuzzy.
One thing I think would be awesome if you could get grad students or master's students at nearby universities. We're right next to Caltech and we've got a lot of really good partners there. And I said, look, I don't need you on a weekly basis, but once a week, could you give 3 hours each graduate student or each postdoc just to meet with the students at a community college, which isn't asking a lot.
No, it's not.
That's the key, is near peer mentoring.
I just want to say, I cannot emphasize enough the importance of good teachers. Yes, and I had my share of poor classes too.
Well, that's the key, is if we can get really good teachers at community colleges just to get the students more engaged in their education.
Well, there isn't enough emphasis put on teaching. Okay, now things are starting to change on how they're doing tenure in the universities. But I can remember 15 years ago going to a tenure meeting and they added up the grant money and added up the publications. And that was it. And I thought that was just terrible. You know, now people do that because it's easy to do, you know, to do that. Some of the other things to evaluate it is a lot more difficult.
Yeah, it's easy to quantify grants and money.
Yeah, the impact factor of the journal and stuff, that stuff is simple to add up. It's one of the reasons why they do it. It's also very objective, but then you're actually screening out that professor that was a really, really good teacher.
Yeah, I mean, it is tough.
I'm going to leave the meeting. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks. That was fun. It was a fun conversation.
That was chemistry professor and innovator Jared Ashcroft and Temple Grandin. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to Jolene Bailey for production assistance. I'm Sherry Quinn.
How'd You Think of That with Temple Grandin is a production of the Utah STEM Action Center.
This podcast is based upon work supported by the National Science Foundation under grant number 174-5674.
Thank you so much for listening.